Senate. The members of the House rose and applauded their colleagues from the other side of the Capitol. Then the Speaker appointed the committee on the part of the House to conduct the President into the House chamber. He selected Representatives McCormick, Doughton, and Martin. Vice President Barkley then announced his choice for the Senate. They were Senators McFarland, Johnson, and Wherry. Then doorkeeper Melitio has just now entered the House.
The President of the United States.
That was the voice of doorkeeper Miller announcing the arrival of the President. Mr. Truman is just going down the middle aisle of the chamber. He's smiling broadly, and he's shaking hands with members on each side of the aisle. He has now reached the well of the House, and he is about to shake hands with Vice President Barkley and Speaker Sam Rayburn. It's interesting to note that now he is shaking hands with Vice President Barkley and Speaker Sam Rayburn. The members are applauding, as you can hear. And in just a moment, Speaker Sam Rayburn will introduce the President. If the galleries are filled, Mrs. Truman is among the distinguished guests. Now we hear the gavel of Mr. Rayburn.
Wait a minute. Members of the Congress, I have the distinguished honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Congress, this 82nd Congress faces as grave a task as any Congress in the history of our Republic. The actions you take will be watched by the whole world. These actions will measure the ability of a free people acting through their chosen representatives and their free institutions to meet a deadly challenge to their way of life. We can meet this challenge foolishly or wisely. We can meet it timidly or bravely, shamefully or honorably. I know that the 82nd Congress will meet this challenge in a way worthy of our great heritage. I know that your debates will be earnest, responsible, constructive, and to the point. I know that from these debates there will come the great decisions needed to carry us forward. At this critical time, I'm glad to say that our country is in a healthy condition. Our democratic institutions are sound and strong. We have more men and women at work than ever before. We are able to produce more than ever before. In fact, far more than any country ever produced in the history of the world. I am confident that we can succeed in the great task that lies before us. We will succeed, but we must all do our part. We must all act together as citizens of this great republic. As we meet here today, American soldiers are fighting a bitter campaign in Korea. We pay tribute to their courage, devotion, and gallantry. Our men are fighting alongside their United Nations allies because they know, as we do, that the aggression in Korea is a part of the attempt of the Russian communist dictatorship to take over the world, step by step. Our men are fighting a long way from home, but they are fighting for our lives and our liberties. They are fighting to protect our right to meet here today, our right to govern ourselves as a free nation. The threat of world conquest by Soviet Russia endangers our liberty and endangers the kind of world in which the free spirit of men can survive. This threat is aimed at all peoples who strive to win or defend their own freedom and national independence. Indeed, the state of our nation is, in great part, the state of our friends and allies throughout the world. The gun that points at them points at us also. The threat is a total threat, and the danger is a common danger. All free nations are exposed, and all are in peril. Their only security lies in banding together. No one nation can find protection in a selfish search for a safe haven from the storm. The free nations do not have any aggressive purpose. We want only peace in the world, peace for all countries. No threat to the security of any nation is concealed in our plans and programs. We had hoped that the Soviet Union, with its security assured by the Charter of the United Nations, would be willing to live and let live. But I'm sorry to say that has not been the case. The imperialism of the czars has been replaced by the even more ambitious, more crafty, and more menacing imperialism of the rulers of the Soviet Union. This new imperialism has powerful military forces. It is keeping millions of men under arms. It has large air force and a strong submarine force. It has complete control of the men and equipment of its satellites. It has kept its subject peoples and its economy in a state of perpetual mobilization. The present rulers of the Soviet Union have shown that they are willing to use this power to destroy the free nations and win domination over the whole world. The Soviet imperialists have two ways of going about their destructive work. They use the method of subversion and internal revolution, and they use the method of external aggression. In preparation for either of these methods of attack, they stir up class strife and disorder. They encourage sabotage. They put out poisonous propaganda. They deliberately try to prevent economic improvement. If their efforts are successful, they foment a revolution, as they did in Czechoslovakia and China, and as they tried unsuccessfully to do in Greece. If their methods of subversion are blocked, and if they think they can get away with outright warfare, they resort to external aggression. This is what they did when they loosed the armies of their puppet states against the Republic of Korea in an evil war by proxy. We of the free world must be ready to meet both of these methods of Soviet action. We must not neglect one or the other. The free world has power and resources to meet these two forms of aggression. Resources that are far greater than those of the Soviet dictatorship. We have skilled and vigorous peoples, great industrial strength, and abundant sources of raw materials. And above all, we cherish liberty. Our common ideals are a great part of our strength. These ideals are the driving force of human progress. The free nations believe in the dignity and the worth of man. We believe in independence for all nations. We believe that free and independent nations can band together into a world order based on law. We have laid the cornerstone of such a peaceful world in the United Nations. We believe that such a world order can and should spread the benefits of modern science and industry, better health and education, more food and rising standards of living throughout the world. These ideals give our cause a power and vitality that Russian communism can never command. The free nations, however, are bound together by more than ideals. They are a real community bound together also by the ties of self-interest and self-preservation. If they should fall apart, the results would be fatal to human freedom. Our own national security is deeply involved with that of the other free nations. While they need our support, we equally need theirs. Our national safety would be gravely prejudiced if the Soviet Union were to succeed in harnessing to its war machine the resources and the manpower of the free nations on the borders of its empire. If Western Europe were to fall to Soviet Russia, it would double the Soviet supply of coal, and triple the Soviet supply of steel. If the free countries of Asia and Africa should fall into Soviet Russia, we would lose the sources of many of our most vital raw materials, including uranium. Including uranium, which is the basis of our atomic power. And Soviet command of the manpower of the free nations of Europe and Asia would confront us with the military forces which we could never hope to equal. In such a situation, the Soviet Union could impose its demands on the world without resort to conflict, simply through the preponderance of its economic and military power. The Soviet Union does not have to attack the United States to secure domination of the world. It can achieve its ends by isolating us and swallowing up all our allies. Therefore, even if we were craven enough, and I do not believe that we could be, I say even if we are craven enough to abandon our ideals, it would be disastrous for us to withdraw from the free community of free nations. We are the most powerful single member of this community, and we have a special responsibility. We must take the leadership in meeting the challenge to freedom and in helping to protect the rights of independent nations. This country has a practical, realistic program of action for meeting this challenge. First, we shall have to extend economic assistance where it can be effective. The best way to stop subversion by the Kremlin is to strike at the roots of social injustice and economic disorder. People who have jobs, homes, and hopes for the future will defend themselves against the underground agents of the Kremlin. Our programs of economic aid have done much to turn back communism. In Europe, the Marshall Plan has had an electrifying result. As European recovery progressed, the strikes led by the Kremlin's agents in Italy and France failed. All over Western Europe, the Communist Party took worse and worse beatings at the polls. The countries which have received Marshall Plan aid have been able, through hard work, to expand their productive strength, in many cases to levels higher than ever before in their history. Without this strength, they would be completely incapable of defending themselves today. They are now ready to use this strength in helping to build a strong combined defense against aggression. We shall need to continue some economic aid to European countries. This aid should now be specifically related to the building of their defenses. In other parts of the world, our economic assistance will need to be more broadly directed toward economic development. In the Near East, in Africa, in Asia, we must do what we can to help people who are striving to advance from misery, poverty, and hunger. We must also continue to help the economic growth of our good neighbors in this hemisphere. These actions will bring greater strength for the free world. They will give many people a real stake in the future and reason to defend their freedom. They will mean increased production of goods they need and materials we need. Second, we shall need to continue our military assistance to countries which want to defend themselves. The heart of our defense effort is the North Atlantic community. The defense of Europe is the basis for the defense of the whole free world, ourselves included. Next to the United States, Europe is the largest workshop in the world. It is also a homeland of the great religious beliefs shared by many of our citizens, beliefs which are now threatened by the tide of atheistic communism. Strategically, economically and morally, the defense of Europe is a part of our own defense. That is why we have joined with the countries of Europe in the North Atlantic Treaty pledging ourselves to work with them. There has been much discussion recently over whether the European countries are willing to defend themselves. Their actions are answering this question. Our North Atlantic Treaty partners have strict systems of universal military training. Several have recently increased the term of service. All have taken measures to improve the quality of training. Forces are being trained and expanded as rapidly as the necessary arms and equipment can be supplied from their factories and ours. Our North Atlantic Treaty partners together are building armies bigger than our own. None of the North Atlantic Treaty countries, including our own country, has done enough yet, but real progress is being made. Together, we have worked out defense plans. The military leaders of our own country took part in working out these plans and are agreed that they are sound and within our capabilities. To put these plans into action, we sent to Europe last week one of our greatest military commanders, General Dwight D. Eisenhower.